Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. We are talking about tax strategy today. Hey, Ryan, how you doing?
We are doing great. By the time this show airs, it'll be the day after Memorial Day. So hope everybody had a holiday, you know, great weekend. And I was able to jump in a plane, fly down to Oregon with the family for the weekend. Super fun trip. One of my favorite GA trips is to take a plane from, you know, wherever I go from Washington or Seattle, Washington, Renton Airport, and go down to Sun River, Oregon, where you can stay at the lodge and ride your bikes, and it's amazing. So
I've heard Sun River's awesome. We got to check that out.
Yeah, but today we are talking taxes. We've got a lot going on, and we've got a bill moving through the house,
Big, beautiful bill. Big, beautiful. What a name.
I feel like we should have a Trump, you know, recording or something. Big, beautiful tax bill. Yeah, I'm not good at doing an impression of Trump, and I'm not going to attempt one. But we have lots of tax code changes coming up, and this episode is going to help you kind of navigate and think about some of the things that might impact you as an investor. But then also we're going to go into some pretty interesting things. I mean, Tom is and his team are kind of plugged into the tax code. He's one of the partners here at Hall CPAs, and we're going to dive into all the things tax related. And he's just a wealth of information. And by the way, I mentioned this at the end of the show too, but you know, you can always go into our forum, Passive Income Pilots, on Facebook and ask tax question, because Nathan is in there as well. But Tate, what else you got? What else do we have? What else are we talking about today?
So Tom Castelli is a CPA, certified public accountant, and focuses on real estate investors and business owners. Obviously, he's a partner at Hall CPA, and I came across Hall CPA because of their specialty in real estate professional status, and they've kind of become a staple in our stable of third-party vendors. They're who I use for my personal tax strategy, and they're a wealth of information. I really like the way they conduct business, and they've been a great resource for us. Ryan, as you mentioned, Nathan Sosa, my personal tax strategist from Hall CPA, is in the Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots on Facebook. So if you jump in there and you ask a question, we can tag Nathan and say, hey, what do you think about this? But Thomas he runs their marketing department and is one of the partners at Hall CPA, as mentioned. So lots of knowledge on, you know, what to do as a pilot, you know, who this makes sense for to pay the money to have this kind of advisory, who it maybe does not make sense for, how to set up your bookkeeping, whether you need an LLC to buy a rental property, all that and more in this episode to come.
Let's get into it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Tom, I think that right now it's like the most interesting time because there is a huge tax bill going through, and you know, it hasn't passed yet as of the airing of or the recording of this podcast, I should say, but like what's going on?
Yeah. Long story short, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that were put in place back in 2017, a lot of those provisions are beginning to expire this year and next year and into 2027. And really what the new administration wants to do is revamp and kind of revise that and extend that out. And there's a lot of key provisions in there. Now, as of this recording today, it just got passed by the House. However, so now it has to go into the Senate, and Senate has to make their comments and their marks, and they ultimately have to pass it before it does make it to the president's desk where it could be signed to law. Now, within this bill, there are a lot of things going on, but there's a few key highlights that probably real estate investors should be aware of. Of course, the number one thing that I think real estate investors are going to be most excited about is the return of 100% bonus depreciation. And 100% bonus depreciation has been huge from the tail end of 2017. Through 2022, but then it began to phase out, and the amount of the deductions you can claim in the first year you own a property, you know, has waned as that has phased out. But if this comes back, and it looks very, very, very likely to come back at this point, real estate investors are going to be able to go back to taking substantial deductions in the first year, which often leads to substantial tax savings.
Just a note on that, if you're listening and you're like, what? Okay, what does that mean? That means that real estate is all of a sudden going to be this vehicle that gives you an amazing tax write-off, like more than what you're getting now. And the last time we had this was 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020. And everyone knows what real estate did during those times. So I'm not saying that it's going to do that again, but this is going to be a turbocharger on real estate if this passes. And what you're saying is it's close to being in the final stages. I have a question though. So the House shot this bill down, like House Republicans, I believe, voted against this thing the first time around. What was fixed in it that made it go through this time?
Yeah, so it was mainly around the SALT deduction, so the state local income tax deduction. Back in 2017, they capped that. So for example, you're able to deduct your state and property taxes for the most part against your federal income taxes. And there was no cap on that back before 2017, but that in 2017 they put a $10,000 cap on it. This time around, they aimed to raise it to $30,000, and there was still some debate on that with people from certain states, high income states like New York and California, and what have you, saying no, it needs to be much higher. So there was a lot of debate around that. I know it did pass this morning. I have not had a chance to take a look exactly what they changed in there, if anything, but I know that was the major thing holding it back.
So we're recording this on May 22nd for reference. Tom, can you provide some context? You know, if somebody's just tuning into this show and they're just kind of getting up to speed, maybe you can recap, go back to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. If somebody wasn't really paying attention to that bill during Trump's first term, what were the key changes to the tax code that occurred under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act? Just so we can have a frame of reference in terms of Trump's second term here and what's sort of coming back.
And the reason why that question is so important, Tate, is because what Thomas said earlier, which is this is basically an extension of that,
right,
of that original bill, right? So like this is just kind of the Trump administration coming back in and saying, hey, we want to basically go back to what we did, that everything kind of expired, and then we're resurrecting a lot of the things that died, right? With maybe some adjustments.
Absolutely. You can absolutely touch on the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and why that was so pivotal. The first and number one thing, which I think most investors really care about, again, is going to be 100% bonus depreciation. So that introduced 100% bonus depreciation for a while. It was 50% for a period of time, but then they raised it to 100, meaning that you could deduct 100% of property that has a depreciable life 20 years or less in the first year you acquire a property. And depending on the type of real estate it is, you're looking around somewhere between 20 to 30% of that property's value in the first year, which could be substantial. So that was the first thing that was really powerful for real estate investors. Some other things in there that really kind of were highlights were the condensed tax brackets. So before you had tax brackets going all the way up to 39.6%. Now they've reduced that down to 37%, and they actually are going to continue to extend that. That was on the table to be on the chopping block soon. Additionally, they introduced the Opportunity Zone programs, the Qualified Opportunity Funds, which meant that if you were to invest in Qualified Opportunity Zones and you did it through a vehicle called a Qualified Opportunity Fund, which is more or less a specially designed partnership or corporation, that you're able to get tax benefits when you invested capital gains from the sale of capital assets into these funds. What it allows you to do, basically you deferred that tax, that capital gains tax, and you got a step up if you held it for a certain period of time, up to 15%. Now, the real benefit of qualified opportunity zones is if you held the investment in the fund for 10 years or more, then the gain on the investment in the fund itself was completely tax-free, including depreciation recapture. So that was important, and they ended up, they're extending that out a little bit as well.
And by the way, this isn't just for real estate investors. If you're an airplane buyer,
right,
now that 100% bonus depreciation comes back to an airplane, because if you're buying an airplane for business, now you can deduct it potentially, if this passes, 100% again, right? This is like heavy equipment, machinery, anything that has that, what Tom says, the less than the 20 years of useful life. So not just real estate, but all things like, you know, buying and entering the service that depreciate.
And if I can tag onto that as well, it's my understanding, Tom, that something unique to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act is that in previous forms of bonus depreciation over many decades of U.S. history, it was only for new equipment,
right?
Because they wanted to spur manufacturing, right? And in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, it applied to new to you. So you could buy a used vehicle, airplane, whatever, and bonus depreciation would apply. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. That appears to be the same case this time around as well.
Yeah. And that's just to highlight, this isn't for your personal use. You've got to do it in a way that it's a business use, right? So we have episodes on that. We talk to Luke Lyson from the Flight Academy about how to lease back an airplane and how to get the tax write-off and all that. So we have episodes that dive deep into how to make an airplane deductible. So if you want to listen to that, jump back to our episode and we will talk about that.
And with bonus depreciation coming back, okay, so coming back to this new bill, this is why, you know, as real estate investors, we're so excited about this, is, you know, I remember Toby Mathis talking about bonus depreciation. Everybody in 2018 and 19 was going, oh, I need more real estate. Give me that real estate, because they want these write-offs. So can you, there's obviously the component of having to do a cost segregation study, and you can go back and listen to that. But Tom, can you break down why are we all so excited about this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's a few reasons. But the first reason is that there's something called the real estate professional status, and we can talk about short-term rentals as well. Basically, the real estate professional status allows you to take losses from your long-term and midterm rental properties and use it to offset non-passive income, which includes things like W-2 income, business income, and portfolio income, like interest, dividends, things, capital gains from sale of stocks, bonds, etc. And that can be quite powerful. To give a quick example of how this works, like once you're able to take these losses, is that they're typically driven by the non-cash expense called depreciation, which basically reduces your taxable income, often causing a loss. So you're telling the IRS, hey, I lost money, despite the fact that you may actually be generating positive cash flow. So give an example. Let's just say you bought a $500,000 property. We're going to keep things relatively tame here today. Land is never depreciated, so we always have to back land out of the calculation. That's determined on an appraisal or independent appraisal or by the property tax card. But we're going to assume it's 80% here today for the purposes of this calculation. And with that's going to leave us with a property value or building value of $400,000. And then somewhere between 20 to 30% of that is going to be eligible for bonus depreciation through a cost seg study. Let's just say it's 25%, split it right down the middle. That's a $100,000 deduction, right? And with today, as it stands under current law, bonus depreciation is 40%. So that means you'd get a $40,000 deduction. But with 100%, you're getting a $100,000 deduction today. And if you're at the, let's call it the 35% tax bracket, that $100,000 deduction is going to save you $35,000 in taxes at 37%, 37,000, 24%, 24,000, so on and so forth. So that's a substantial tax savings that you can go ahead and use to reduce your tax and ideally reinvest into your portfolio and continue to grow.
One thing that the tax bill didn't do was it talked about fiscal conservatives have concern over the national debt. So that was one of the reasons why I think it was shot down, because it was going to add $3.8 trillion to the deficit. So can you kind of talk through that? What do you know about that? Or what was some of the issues there on the first go around?
Yeah, so there was a lot of debate too around like energy credits. So part of the way that they're paying for this is phasing out certain energy credits, like the Tesla tax credit, for example, and things like that. And there was just debate around, different constituents wants to not do that, wants people who do want to do that, how is this all going to get paid for? So that was part of the debate there. But ultimately tariffs, they're hoping to raise additional money through tariffs that were currently in place. But that was, from my understanding, the energy credits was part of what was in play there.
Makes sense. So I saw on the tax bill, there was a MAGA savings account.
That's right. I saw this too.
Yeah.
I want to hear about it.
Yeah, I kind of want to hear about it. It said that it, from my understanding, it introduces a $1,000 savings account for children born between 2024 and 2028 with tax deferred growth similar to 401ks. What did you hear the nuances to this?
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to be honest with you, Ryan. I'm not aware of the nuances of the MAGA account at this moment.
Yeah. So it's something worth looking into. Again, the bill hasn't passed yet, but something worth looking into is that similar to a 401k, you can basically start stuffing money into this account when your kid is born. And then when they, I think you can get it back out for any reason when they get into their 20s or something to that effect. You might want to do a little bit more research on that if you're listening, but I thought that was a very interesting proposal. So yeah, definitely something worth looking into.
I'm reading on CNBC. It says the package includes a new savings account for children with a one-time deposit of $1,000 from the federal government. It's funded by the Department of the Treasury. Trump accounts, in quotation marks, previously known as money accounts for growth and advancement or MAGA accounts, and they can be later used for education expenses or credentials or the down payment of a first home or as the capital to start a small business. So interesting.
Yeah. And another one for pilots that I thought was kind of interesting, increasing the standard deduction, because I know, Tom, we're going to talk about pilots that talk to you and you might just, they might call you and they might say, I don't do anything but fly the line and do Tater Ryan syndication. And they might just be kind of in the standard deduction bucket, but it looks like it's proposed to increase to $26,000 for joint filers and $19,500 for head of household, or and $13,000 for single filers, whatever the difference is. What's the difference between heads of household and single filers? What is that?
Yeah. So heads of household are basically if you're a single parent, for example, or you have certain dependents that that qualifies you for a head of household, which gives you slightly increased a deduction because you have a little bit more burden than just a regular single person would have.
Okay. I've got a question, and I know the lawyers are going to interpret this endlessly for like the next 5 years. Exemption for tips and overtime. This is like a $1 million question, probably. Like, what defines a tip? Can I, like, instead of charging an acquisition fee for my real estate, can I call it a tip?
that's a great question. And in the language of the bill, it says in business, it customarily receive a tip. So there, it's like, is it already customary, right? Like, because joked around internally, like, oh yeah, well, what we do, we just get tipped, right? We don't.
Right.
You know, but no, it's the bill makes it clear that it's for businesses that were businesses or workers who would be currently who like are customarily doing it.
So it's possible that charter pilots could claim. Of course, I mean, if it's in cash, it probably doesn't get claimed anyway. But
yeah. Remember, tip your pilots. For those passengers, that's what the hats are for. You take the hat off, put the tip in the hat, right? Great landing, good service. You know, slip your pilot a little bit of money. You know, I mean, you give your barista. Tip now, so tip your pilot, people.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, and I definitely agree. There's going to be some debate over the language in there for sure. There's going to be some people trying to figure out unique ways to use it, but the way I kind of read it when I read it, it was like, okay, if you're customarily receiving tips, then you're going to be in a good place. But we'll see what people come up with.
But the overtime thing is huge. I mean, pilots fly overtime all the time. It's just
that's one I really wanted to get into because I mean, we have. Minimum guarantee. I mean, is this something that pilots are going to be able to take advantage of if overtime is not taxed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And long story short, like I'm fortunate enough to have a huge team behind me who one of our guys, Nathan, he is keeping very, very close tabs on this bill until everything is finalized and be able to distribute out how everything's going to fall. But the no tax on overtime is definitely something people are going to want to keep a look at if you do work overtime. Because from my understanding of it right now is that basically if you're working overtime over a certain amount of hours, you're going to be able to get a deduction for all of that time that would ordinarily be considered overtime. And that's going to be a function of what's on your W-2. And basically what's going to happen is it's going to be a deduction on your tax return for that overtime. So how that all is finalized and ultimately implemented will be interesting to see, but we'll definitely keep an eye on it for sure.
So we're gonna have you or Nathan back on the show when this passes, and we're gonna break this down. But I just appreciate our partnership together, having Hall in our back corner, here working with our back pocket, working with our pilots and our staying up on this stuff. That's great. I mean, some other things in here that I saw, like enhanced child credit. We talked about the SALT deduction, Medicaid cuts in work requirements. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Reductions on the green incentives, basically. They're kind of rolling back. You were talking about that earlier, Tom. What about student loan program changes? Any familiarity with some of that? Because there's like a federal subsidized loan for undergraduate students and proposed big taxes on large university endowments. I thought that was pretty substantial and might impact the investing world. Because a lot of these endowments buy real estate and invest in a market, right? So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, with the student loans, candidly, I'm not up to date on the student loan stuff within this bill. But assuming there is going to be aid for student loans, where you see is more capital to spend in the economy, which means it's going to benefit the economy as well as potential for those students who are investment minded. They may go ahead and take some of the savings they have and go ahead and invest it, whether it be in real estate or otherwise. So there could be additional capital flowing into the marketplace too. Yeah,
that's interesting. Now, you are very knowledgeable about what's coming, what is, what isn't. And I think what's really helpful for pilots is, you know, having a resource to call to kind of help them strategize through sort of what they're doing in their personal portfolio and in their business portfolio and how to best maximize their tax efficiency. Can you kind of talk about some of the things that you go through when you talk to a pilot about, hey, you know, what are you doing? What is going to help you become more efficient, et cetera?
Yeah. So it depends if it's a business owner or going to be someone who's doing a W-2. If it's a business owner, we are looking at two things, right? We're looking at how can we optimize your business, right? That you're running, which includes things like home office deductions. Want to make sure people are taking that. Believe it or not, I spoke to someone the other day who told me their accountant didn't allow them to take a home office deduction, despite the fact that they were clearly qualified to do so. Vehicle deductions. So that could be if you're doing a lot of traveling for your business, you're using a vehicle like a car. We evaluate that. If you're going to be doing an airplane, in the case of a pilot, we can help evaluate that. And that's something we're looking at. How can we optimize these deductions? Are you using the right entity structure? So as a business owner, you are subject to something called the self-employment tax, which is 15.3% of your income up to a threshold. It's north of $160,000 this year, right? And how can we help you minimize your exposure to that tax? And we can often do that through S corporation. So we want to make sure that your entities are structured correctly to maximize tax savings. And also, what other deductions are you able to take as a business owner? Are you considering using retirement accounts for your future and also tax savings today? And the answer to that question varies dependent on each individual person. But these are the types of things we're looking at on the business side. When we transition a little bit more, are you taking advantage of the QBI deduction too? So the QBI deduction is a qualified business income deduction, currently at 20%. But they want to bring it up to 23% in this bill. So that's a nice perk. Are people taking advantage of that? Are they optimized for that? Then we look at the real estate side.
Could you explain what the QBI deduction is and how it works? I don't think we've touched on that on this show before.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So the QBI deduction is actually also called qualified business income deduction, or section 199A is what a lot of people refer to it. And basically they implemented this because back in the 2017 Jobs Act, they lowered the corporate tax rate significantly, and they wanted a way to balance things out for the small business owners. So they said, look, we're going to give you a deduction of 20% of your business income as a deduction. It's called the QBI deduction. And this time around, they're actually looking to bring it up another 3%. So long story short, it allows you to deduct 20% of your business income.
Tom, I got it. Burning question. You know, you talked about all the amazing things that you can help a client with. You know, when do you sort of interview a client and say, you know, it probably would be better off for you to just go enter this stuff onto TurboTax? Or would you suggest that, you know, or maybe go to H&R Block? Because like, if you're doing a lot of very specialty things, you could have hundreds of thousands, if not millions in dollars in tax savings. And it pales into comparison to what, you know, a strategy session costs or a strategy, you know, engagement costs. When does a pilot sort of like, when do you kind of say to that person, you know, you're not really planning on doing anything substantial and you're not doing anything substantial. So maybe just do your taxes a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. In a situation like that would be a handful of situations. The first one's going to be if you have a job and you're investing in real estate syndicates and funds on the side, probably not going to be a whole lot of value in a larger tax planning engagement, because there's only but so many moves that you can make. And in situations like that, we would recommend hopping on like a one-on-one call for like an hour, and we'll be able to help set the record straight for you in that case. Because there's a few things you could do. Really, in that case, just managing your passive losses, making sure you're not paying taxes on the income that you're generating from these funds. And when you sell, making sure that you're minimizing taxes on the back end, which is just a function of managing the losses that you're receiving from these investments. So that can often be done. So
Yeah. So what you're saying, just to kind of make sure everybody's following along. So like, let's say you invest in one of our deals, a syndication, and it's in, and it's distributing monthly distributions or quarterly distributions to you. And you're saying that you're just going to kind of put a comb through, making sure that those distributions are being shielded by some passive losses that may have been generated by the investment, and that that's being accounted for. Do I have that right?
Yeah, correct. Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We want to make sure that's happening. Maybe some of your losses from your other investments are able to offset it. That's kind of what we're looking at.
Also, keep in mind that when you have suspended losses from a passive deal that you might have invested in and that deal sells, this is something that I think a lot of CPAs get wrong, is those losses, if they're carried forward, you still have them on the shelf and they haven't been used to offset anything, they convert to ordinary losses and they can go to chase down your W-2 income at that time.
Right, right. So what happens is whenever you sell or completely dispose of an asset, any associated losses with it become quote unquote unlocked. And at that point, they're able to help offset non-passive income as well.
Right. So if you're in a deal that has gone full cycle, has sold, make sure that in that calendar year, you're having an astute CPA look at those losses, if you still have them left, so that they're being accurately applied.
Right. Tom, you know, a lot of pilots I see ask, you know, hey, does anybody have a CPA in Georgia or a CPA in Florida or a CPA in their hometown? How relevant is that? And do you guys do taxes for everybody in every state?
Yeah, so we have clients in all 50 states at this point, except for North Dakota. And there's no real reason for that, other than just how the chips have fallen. But I think at the end of the day, if you're working with a firm who has the staff, the experience, the research capabilities, the software to be able to service people in all 50 states, having someone local to your market is often, I would say, overrated or maybe a misconception. Because you know, we've worked with clients in almost all 50 states at this point, and have been able to save them tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, all yeah. remotely without having to meet in person or be located right in their state.
Now, if someone comes to you and says, "Hey, you know, I would really like to engage you guys to do my taxes," and they explain, "Okay, I'm just flying the line. I'm a W-2 employee. I don't have very much." Do you still do their tax return or do you just say, hey, go do it yourself or go to H&R Block? Like what's the best way to kind of handle the tax return from that point?
Yeah, I mean, if we're working with somebody who is doing a lot of advanced tax strategy and planning and implementing a lot of advanced stuff, we would absolutely want to handle their return for them. Here's the reason why. First is that most traditional CPAs or their prior CPA, there's a reason why they left. And they're either not well versed in all these strategies and cannot actually have the capability to actually complete these tax returns, or they're not aligned on the strategy and just won't do it. So oftentimes we'd want to take that over. Secondly, doing it yourself. A lot of these do-it-yourself softwares like TurboTax or H&R Block and TaxAct and what have you, they don't have the capability to allow the user to actually file these things. Like for example, with the short-term rental loophole, they're unable to actually allow you to file that correctly on these commercial softwares. However, conversely, where it would make sense to do that is like if you are doing syndicates and funds as a primary investment, or maybe you have just one rental property, you can probably get away with using TurboTax or H&R Block because there's not that much advanced stuff going on. And I know in the past, I used to use TurboTax to do my return when I had syndicates and funds. So basically is, if you're applying advanced strategies, you're going to want to have a specialist do it for you. There's just too much things that can go wrong and not enough capability on commercial do-it-yourself software. But if you have a relatively tame situation, like you have a job and you're investing in syndicates and funds, you can typically do that through like an H&R Block or like a TurboTax or have your local guy do it.
Do you want to talk briefly about how Hall bifurcates strategy and filing into two different buckets and they're separately built?
Yeah, absolutely. So the issue with most CPAs out there, the traditional CPAs, your local people, is that they only provide you with tax preparation, right? So they prepare your tax returns, they put the numbers on the form, they file it, they say, see you next year. And that's a very important part of the process. But the issue is there's also the strategy and planning that goes into actually saying, here's what you can do, here's how you do it, here's what applies to you, so that when it does come time to file your tax return, you're getting better results. So what we've found is that there's two different skill sets at the end of the day. The reason why a lot of CPAs don't provide it is because they don't want to talk to people. They want to just sit behind their tax return, sit behind their screens, file the tax returns, and kind of not talk to people as much as they can. Also, they don't have the foresight and the strategic thinking to align things in a certain way that are going to come up with results. So the reason why we bifurcate this is really again twofold. The strategists who can actually help advise you often have a different type of personality than the person who's filing your return. Additionally, when it comes time to actually being available for the strategy, if you're busy in tax season, heads down filing tax returns, trying to meet deadlines, it's very difficult to pop your head up and be able to meet with people on strategy sessions. So what we found is that by taking these two and kind of taking them apart, you're able to get people who are able to provide better advice because they're better suited for doing that, and also do it year round, including during tax season when people sometimes do need advice, strategic advice, whether it be this year or for prior years. And then also having the tax preparation team be able to stay focused on that, they're able to drive results home. And the way we're able to kind of connect the two together is we have various systems in place that allow our advisory team and tax team to communicate both in sync as well as via note-taking processes to make sure that everything that's discussed on the advisory side and all the strategies and plans that are laid out ultimately make it onto the tax return. But that's kind of
right. I have a trademark saying to summarize what you just said. There are right-brained CPAs and left-brained CPAs.
Right.
And you can go to firms like Hall where you get right and left brain accountants.
That's a great.
Right? You got the creative strategy and you've got the black and white filing, right?
Yep.
And what you don't want to do, from my opinion, is go get a bunch of fancy advice from a podcast and then go to a left brain. Is it left brain that's black and white? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Whoever's preparing your tax return, they don't care what we said on this podcast. They don't, unless you're Hall CPA. But they don't care. They don't care about, you can go, I heard you can do this and do this and do this. And then you hand everything to their CPA and they're like, well, that's nice. Here's what I'm going to do because I'm the one signing your tax return. So that's what's cool about marrying the strategy with the tax preparer is they're in lockstep. They're not uncoordinated because that's what happens, right? Like you can hear all this fancy stuff and then go to your random CPA and they're going to be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't do those things. I just file. I will file. I am scared. I don't want to do any of these creative strategies. I have no idea what you're talking about. Here's your bill. Goodbye.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, that's exactly what happens. And, it's really interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day and I mentioned the home office thing before, but someone also told them another person said their CPA told them they cannot use a cost segregation study.
Yeah.
I asked them a few different questions about their situation. And I'm like, it's very clear that you can. They're probably just telling you that because they don't want to deal with the hassle of actually having to either go through and file it or whatever the case was. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, if you want to work with somebody who's going to be able to do both sides of the coin for you, if you want to really optimize your tax situation.
One thing I wanted to jump to, Tom, we have so many people who own rental properties and the bane of their existence is bookkeeping, keeping track of like income and expenses and receipts and all that stuff. We don't have time for that. So I've gone to my CPAs in the past and I'm like, can you guys do our bookkeeping? And they're like, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Or I've tried to hire like a third party company that does bookkeeping and they're terrible. And again, you've got to align their bookkeeping with whatever your CPA wants to say or see. So can you guys talk about what kind of services you do for rental property owners and bookkeeping?
Yeah, absolutely. At the most basic level, we handle your bookkeeping for you. So what does that mean? That means that if you're doing it yourself, chances are you're probably using a spreadsheet, right? And spreadsheets can only take you so far before it starts to become a mess and very tedious and very manual. So the first thing we want to look at is getting you onto a dedicated bookkeeping system. Now, we tend to prefer for the vast majority of our clients to use QuickBooks Online. And QuickBooks Online allows you to do a few different things in the bookkeeping process. It allows you to connect all your bank accounts and your credit cards and feed all that data into a system. And then in that system, what we can do is we're able to set certain rules and automations, for lack of a better way to put it, up that allow certain transactions to be automatically categorized, income and expenses and what have you, to give you a better picture of what's going on. So you don't have to manually do it on a spreadsheet. Now, there's always going to be some manual transactions and journal entries that have to be made within that. But that's all function of that accounting system. So what we'll often do for clients is we'll set up the accounting system for you, bring it current year to date, so that you are in a spot where it's like, okay, here's what happened this year. Here's what happened last month, so on and so forth. And then we can actually take over that monthly accounting for you in order to basically allow you to be hands-free. And we can categorize everything, keep giving you monthly reports. So that's at the most basic level. You're setting up your accounting system, keeping it current, and you're getting reports that you can then use to interpret yourself, or we can take it to the next level from there, which I'm happy to talk about.
I want a few tips and tricks on the bookkeeping side, but I want to actually back it up, because you said, you know, you can connect your bank accounts and credit cards. And I know there's somebody out there going, do I need separate banks and credit cards?
That's good.
So let's back up before then, because pilots are, you know, out there. They're like, oh, I found this cool rental property. It's like, okay, you found that cool rental property, whether it's long-term, short-term, whatever. What are some of the key things they need to do in order to keep the transactions that are going to be associated with that property separate?
Yeah. So the first thing you want to do, and I guess, this is very foundational. It's like, you want to keep a business and personal account separate, right?
And this is even if you don't have an LLC, right? Everybody thinks like, first thing I need to do is set up an LLC. It's like, well, you don't really, right?
Right. You don't need an LLC. Plenty of people operate businesses without an LLC. However, having a separate business and personal account, which you can do with either an LLC or not, to your point, is essential. Because here's the thing, commingling expenses is one of the most frustrating things to have to untangle, and can lead you into a lot of trouble. I mean, there's clients we've seen who've deducted personal expenses and could lead to a lot of back taxes and penalties and what have you, if those things are ever figured out, right? But so what this does is this. The first thing it does is, okay, if you have a business bank account, you know that everything in that business bank account is business, right? There's no guessing. You don't have to second guess. Was this personal? Was this a business expense? You know that, right? And you know everything in your personal account is personal. And sometimes seldomly intermingle, short, but most of the time you're going to know that this is clean. And when you hook up that bank account, you hook up that business credit card to your QuickBooks or to your accounting software, you're going to know that every transaction came through there, and that allows you to set up those rules and automations and be able to also help your accountant who's doing your bookkeeping know that everything in there is business and categorize it appropriately.
One bank account per property.
Well, yes. Yes to...
Yes, no?
That to an extent. If you have a million and one properties, right? If you have dozens, right? Having one bank account for each property can become problematic, in the sense that now you have a lot of accounts. So oftentimes what you'll see is people start to consolidate them into you'll have a holding company structure up here. And again, you don't need LLCs to do this, but this is what you'll see. You'll have a holding company, then you will have property LLCs underneath that holding company, and you'll start grouping. You'll start seeing multiple properties being grouped into one LLC, and that one LLC can have a bank account. So now you might have three properties in one. Yeah.
And when you do that, you need a good bookkeeper to do your journal. They're called journal entries, right? Not everything's going to ebb and flow out of those bank accounts. So you need a great bookkeeper to help you with the journal entries, to put them into the correct categories, because you need P&Ls for all these different things, most likely, depending on how you're running them. So help you with the journal entries. But I really wanted to nerd out on something real quick. I think investors tend to classify capitalization expenses in the wrong bucket of repairs and maintenance quite frequently.
Yeah.
Great subject.
And there are downstream impacts to that. And the two major ones are, you're probably thinking something is a repair and maintenance. And I know everyone's like, and I don't want to spend an hour talking about the difference, but you probably think something goes in the repair and maintenance line item, which goes on your profit and loss statement.
Yep.
But it's probably something that needs to be capitalized to your balance sheet. And here's the major difference. When you go to sell the property, the buyer is going to look at your P&L to determine the value based on NOI divided by cap rate. And if you incorrectly categorized repairs and maintenance, it's going to hurt your valuation. If you correctly capitalize your improvements to the property, they go on your balance sheet, and they become tax deductible because they get entered in as a 15-year or 5-year life. So, or part of the building, right? So just if you have a bookkeeper who knows what they're doing, who's then going to translate into your CPA, you could be saving yourself a lot of time, headache, and potentially tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions, if you're depending on the size of the property. So proper bookkeeping and accounting is fundamental to real estate investing.
Absolutely. Brian, I'm so glad you brought that up. Tom, can you, for anybody that's a little lost, can you explain the difference between a repair expense and capitalizing and depreciating something?
Yeah, absolutely. So minor repairs, like for example, things that are like under $2,500, you can usually automatically deduct because they're minor and they're actually repairing something. Like say, for example, you were to repair a few shingles on your roof, right? That is most likely a repair expense. But if you're replacing your entire roof, that is often to be considered a renovation or a capital expense that you're going to have to add to your balance sheet, add to your depreciation schedule, and begin to depreciate over time. So repairs and maintenance are usually on the smaller side where you're just fixing something. But if you're totally replacing something, it's often going to be considered a capital improvement. And that's what you just have to watch out for. Happy to dive deeper into that.
So the benefit of expensing something is you get to take the full deduction that year, right? So you can, you know, you might be thinking, oh, this is great. If I don't capitalize and depreciate it, and I just put it onto my P&L and I claim it as an expense, I'm going to show a loss. That's great. And then I'm going to get a tax deduction for that. But you might shoot yourself in the foot later when you go to sell the property because something that's capitalized and depreciated adds to your basis, unless it's depreciated away.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. In general, in an ideal world, it depends on what game we're playing here. If we're looking at like single family, right, you want to try to put as many things in the repairs and maintenance bucket as possible so you could have as high deductions as possible, as many losses as possible, so that you're able to reduce your income. And yeah, to your point, when you have a repair maintenance, that's deductible in the first and then in the year in which it occurs. When you have a capital expenditure, you're adding it to your basis, and then you're depreciating it over a longer period of time, getting a little bit of a deduction each year. Now, where I think it becomes more strategic in playing the game of capital versus repairs is when you are in the world of real estate syndicates and funds, and you are in like that 5+ unit space in multifamily or commercial, where you're valuing your property off NOI. In that case, you want to ideally capitalize as many things as possible to your balance sheet, because then at that point, it does look more favorable when you do get that valuation. And then additionally, when you sell the property, and again, you had references before, you're going to have a lower capital gain. The higher your basis is, the lower gain you're going to have on the sale of your property. But I wouldn't say that's so much of a, at least in my experience, is not that major of a consideration. Most people would still rather just, if they can make it a repair and maintenance expense this year, just do it.
Right. Well, and this comes down to long-term strategy, right? What? How long are you going to hold this property? You're going to hold it forever? You're going to sell it in 3 years? You're going to sell it in 10 years? All of those things come into play. And this is why it's so important to have a tax strategist when you're playing this game. So again, not for everybody. If you don't have any rental properties, you don't have a business, you don't have anything really going on, then it might just be an expense that doesn't make sense. But if you're going to play this game, it makes sense to have somebody on your bench that can look through this stuff with you. So thank you for clarifying that. And great point, Ryan.
Yeah. And again, you know, one or two rental properties, maybe not the end of the world, but you know, you should at least get some guidance. I mean, heck, have Hall CPA set up your books and get you going, and maybe they do it for a year and then you realize, oh, I got some extra time, I can do these books or something like that. I mean, I'm not trying to encourage you to leave Hall, but you know, maybe, or you get it and you're like, wow, this is really nice. I don't want to ever do this again, which is probably what's going to happen. So yeah.
Look, I mean, I'll say this when it comes to bookkeeping, and this is not to be a self-serving comment. I've realized as I've kind of grown in business, that your time is valuable, whatever it is you're doing, right? And you want to focus your time on the highest and best use of your time. And as a real estate investor, you want to be finding deals, financing deals, maybe raising capital from investors, optimizing your portfolio.
Or if you're an airline pilot, you should be going pick up a double time trip. Don't sit there and do your bookkeeping.
Exactly. You have to look at the value of your time, right? Sign a value to your time. And if you can make a substantial amount more money taking another, you know, picking up some more flights, I would venture to guess that's going to be far more lucrative for you than sitting there doing bookkeeping, which you could delegate for a far lesser rate. So, you know, at the end of the day, when you're starting a business, you need to be scrappy and you need to do things like bookkeeping, maybe to keep, you know, until you can afford to delegate it out. But at some point, you're going to realize, hey, look, bookkeeping is not worth my time. It's just not worth my time. Yeah. It's not worth my sanity. And someone could probably do it better than I can at a cheaper rate than what I can do. Right. So
Tom, we just wanted to thank you so much for coming on, dropping your knowledge. Thanks to Hall CPAs for all the wisdom. And I know that we've had you guys on the show a couple of times. Would you mind, like, how does a listener sort of jump on one of these consultation calls and kind of see where they're at and what they're doing and where they're going? How do listeners learn more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of have two different ways that we would initially start working with somebody. One of them is that we would do a discovery call. They're 30-minute call, free 30 minutes. And we're going to figure out, okay, what do you have going on? Are we a good fit to help you? And if we can help you, what does that look like to have a longer you know, relationship and what we can drive for you? That we do have a link for that I believe you guys have. So that would be specific
to you guys.
That'll be in the show notes.
Right down there.
The second way we could do it is a 60-minute one-on-one paid tax strategy call. And that is where we're taking a look at your prior year tax return, seeing if there's any errors or missed opportunities there. And then also giving you some level of strategic guidance, answering any immediate questions you have. And if there are things that we do uncover in that deeper dive process, then we can let you know. I'd say the one-on-one call is probably best for somebody who is in that syndicate and fund situation where they're investing as a limited partner, because there are certain things that we can give you pointers on, but it wouldn't be worth coming on board for probably an entire long-term strategic engagement, because there just isn't that much there. But if you're a high income earner and you're actively building a portfolio, whether short-term rentals, long-term rentals, that's usually when it makes sense to look at the longer and bigger picture.
Excellent. We'll link to both of those in the show notes. Thomas, thank you again for your time. Look forward to having you on again in the future. Maybe after this bill passes, we can get into some of, more of the nuts and bolts of what actually is going into effect. Okay. Until next time, thank you so much.
And by the way, real quick before we go, if you guys have a tax question, go to our Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots. Nathan from Hall CPAs is in our tax group and will answer your tax questions.
Exactly.
So ask away. We're there for you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having me.